So here we are in Studio O, just north of Philadelphia, in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, bringing to you episode number 59 of Geographical Imaginations, Radio Expeditions into the Geographies of Everything and Nothing. As always, I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox. Looking forward to tonight's episode. We call it Climate Thinking Change. We invite to the show and in conversation, explore with Dr. Lawrence Hamilton the survey data in and around public opinion, not only about the Arctic, but about climate change. Lawrence Hamilton is professor of sociology and senior fellow in the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire, where he teaches courses about society in the Arctic, survey research, and statistical analysis. Dr. Hamilton's research focuses on human-environment interactions in locations ranging from Arctic Alaska to northern New England and the Intermountain West. His most recent papers include Cold Winters Warming, Perceptions of Climate Change in the North Country, Demographic Variation and Change in the Inuit Arctic, A Change in the Wind, U.S. Public Views on Renewable Energy and Climate Compared. It was the article Tracking Public Knowledge and Perceptions about the Arctic that brought me to his work. Tonight, we have a long discussion about survey research, about the Arctic, and about the public perception of climate change. Dr. Lawrence Hamilton joins us from his office at the University of New Hampshire. We ask him how he first got into his research in the Arctic.
Actually, I started out doing field work back in the 1990s in Arctic Alaska, and just got really fascinated with the people and the landscapes and the challenges, and sort of reinvented my career as an Arctic sociologist from that point on.
Yeah. What kind of work were you doing prior to that? Still public opinion work? Or?
Well, honestly, I was a statistician. I taught PhD level courses in statistics, and I'd been telling people for years what a great toolkit this was. You could take these skills anywhere and do anything. And I reached a point where I'd spent like 6 years writing a series of three books and figured, why, that's it. I want to take the show on the road, do something else with my life. And a door opened that took me to Arctic Alaska, and I never looked back.
Yeah, and since then, have you been able to travel to other Arctic countries, you know, eight Arctic countries, mm-hmm. U.S. being one? Have you been able to get to Norway, to Canada, to Russia?
I've been to the Arctic parts of all eight countries, yes.
Yeah. And do you see, I guess, me as a cultural geographer in this show, kind of more about human geography, do you see a lot of cultural similarities in the different places you've been?
Yeah, absolutely. You see, let me put it this way. They all are places that have evolved around natural resources and physical geography.
Yeah.
And oftentimes there is they've been surviving off those resources. That's been their livelihood for centuries to millennia, depending on the culture. And in pretty much every case, that is no longer enough. And you see these cod fishing places all around the North Atlantic Arctic. You see the hunting societies around the North American and Asian Arctic, or the herding in parts of Asia. And in every case, they're looking for, they need, as a culture, they need a plan B. They need something else you can do if the codfish are not going to support your livelihood anymore, if hunting caribou or hunting seal or herding reindeer is no longer enough. And when I initially started out, I thought that there would be really a lot of variety, that there would be 1,000 flowers blooming. People would be coming up with different ideas all over the place, that studying the collapse of the North Atlantic Arctic cod fisheries and herring fisheries, for example, that you have all these different communities coming up with new ways to invent themselves. But what became striking was that there actually Plan B was almost always tourism, and Plan C was sort of find oil or something close to that. And those things were getting were coming up in the discussions pretty much everywhere I went. That with Newfoundland's codfish collapse, there were people saying, well, we've got to capture tourists like Iceland. And then you'd hear that other places. You'd see things like universities being the new economic growth engine, sort of like a coal mine or a fish processing plant used to be. So there are a lot of transitions that all these places are going through, coming from very different backgrounds, but facing some of the same constraints and limited options in the 21st century.
Yeah. So I remember in Svalbard and Longyearbyen, there's now the university center there, and I'm sure it's been there for years, but I think it's growing and growing. So you're seeing that in other Arctic places as well?
Sure, and Longyearbyen at Svalbard is a very nice example. At one time, whale hunting or seal hunting supported an economy there.
Right.
And then as the whales were basically hunted to near extinction and the seals were greatly depleted, there was a shift to industrial coal mining. And then coal mining became less economical. So what is Plan C? And Plan C in Longyearbyen has been the university or Nyalesund, the science. Those are kind of, that's the 21st century answer to what do you do when the whales are gone and the coals run out, and neither of those things will support a modern community.
Yeah. And then like you mentioned the tourism as well.
You could find other examples of that from Tromsø to Akureyri, where a northern university is a growth engine. That's a magnet. And those communities thrive as regional centers then.
Yeah. Now, after your first, trips, explorations of in being in the Arctic, did you come back to your university in New Hampshire and sort of share some of that story? When did you realize that public knowledge and perceptions about the Arctic were so, I don't know, is it fair to say so far off?
Well, it was sort of serendipity. I had this interest and background in doing work in and about the actual Arctic, and I came across a survey project, the General Social Survey in 2006, which is a flagship NSF, nationwide, NSF-supported nationwide survey.
Yeah.
It turned out that they had carried a series of polar knowledge and opinion questions on the 2006 General Social Survey.
Uh-huh.
And the motivation for that was that there was the International Polar Year was coming up in 2007-2008. And the researchers at NSF had the idea of putting a series of polar knowledge questions on the General Social Survey before IPY in 2006, and then repeating them again on the same GSS survey when it was done again in 2010. And so you'd get sort of before and after the IPY assessments of the knowledge about polar regions among the U.S. general public. So I had nothing to do with the design or conception of that work, but when I discovered it, I realized that the data had not really been closely analyzed.
Right.
And that was pretty much my toolkit. That was what I knew how to do, and I was very excited by that and jumped into it. We wrote a paper called Who Cares About Polar Regions that was a detailed analysis of the 2006 polar knowledge questions.
Yeah. So who cares about polar regions?
Well, it turned out to be in some ways the the demographic profile is similar to what you would get about other kinds of environmental issues. And there were, the goal was to learn about polar knowledge, but polar knowledge, it took me a number of years to sort of sort this out, but polar knowledge is really two different things in the U.S. public's imagination. One of them is sort of basic physical or cultural geographic facts. Mm-hmm. But the other one is questions that remind people of their opinions about climate change. So if you ask a question that reminds people of their opinions about climate change, they answer it in that way, as if it were an opinion question, even if it's stated as fact. So you can ask, is Arctic sea ice in late summer cover less area now than it did 30 years ago? And people, that's satellite observation. That's very well quantified by physical scientists. Right. But people will answer that, or many people will answer that, as if you'd ask them, do you believe humans are changing the climate? Hmm. And when I say people will answer it that way, I mean it's the same people who would say, no, humans are not changing the climate, will also say, no, Arctic sea ice is not less than it was 30 years ago.
So they have to answer no to that in order to stay consistent with the other? Is that sort of the thinking there?
Well, I think it isn't really that they have to. On climate change opinions, there's sort of four basic options in the surveys I work with. You can say you just don't know what's happening with climate change, but actually very few people will take that answer. Another possibility is that climate change is not happening, and very few people will say that either. The two popular choices are that it's happening now, caused mainly by human activities, or it's happening now, caused mainly by natural forces. I like these surveys that have fairly stark choices that people turn out to answer very, very reliably, very consistently. Yeah. They answer it the same way next year they would the year before. Anyway, on U.S. surveys, we get something over 60% say climate change is happening now, caused mainly by human activities. And we get something in the 30s saying climate change is happening now, but it's caused mainly by natural forces. So that group, change is happening, but it's natural, could perfectly well say recognize that Arctic sea ice is declining. But by and large, they don't. So it's not actually a matter of consistency. I think it's more a matter of cultural identity.
Yeah, with a certain ideology, certain set of media they follow.
As part of my identity, I don't believe in climate change. I think that's sort of a complex of things that fit together like that. And the more I do surveys, the more I realize that identity explains a whole lot of opinions about lots of issues in science and physical reality, in addition to the opinion items that people already knew it influenced.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
In 2018, you wrote an article as well about the news you choose. How much is the news, our news media preferences, influencing then the view on climate change? Or is it the sort of confirmation bias that people are looking for?
Well, it's both top-down and bottom-up. It's top-down in the sense that there are elites with different political factions that will, and these elites are not just the political leaders, but the media.
Yeah.
And think tanks, could be any sorts of things. These elites that will communicate what is the appropriate view for your social identity. And so people who are aware of their elites are paying attention to that, and they get that message. So that's the top down, but there's a bottom up aspect of it, which is that the news you choose, people will choose to confirmation bias. They will seek things that confirm their prejudices.
Yeah.
And they will remember those things and retain them. So if you read somewhere that Arctic sea ice is declining and you think global warming is actually happening, those two things fit together, and they're likely, the Arctic sea ice decline is likely to become part of what you know. On the other hand, if you're convinced that global warming is a hoax, and you hear that Arctic sea ice is declining, you'll think, well, that's part of the hoax. And, you know, perhaps somewhere else, somebody else will say something that makes it sound like Arctic sea ice is not declining, and you'll remember that instead.
How much of this is age? Is there a generation gap?
There is.
On climate change or even renewable energy?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we have one of our newspapers coming out this year was about generation gaps on climate change and renewable energy. And so I've been talking about the social identity as a predictor of people's views.
Yeah.
But the second most consistent predictor is age. With young people, young adults, much more likely to agree with scientists that humans are changing the climate, and also much more likely to prioritize renewable energy development.
Hmm. Do you have a set? Can you give us a sense when you say young adult? You're talking born after 1990, or?
Well, the way I look at it in the survey data is that I'm usually looking at the 18 to 39 year old age group. Okay. So we don't survey people under 18.
Okay.
And it's sort of a moving window. I was talking about surveys done in 2006, but we've got them now that were done in 2019.
Yeah.
But it's also striking that a lot of things that we find are persistent. If the younger adults voted at the same rate as older adults do, this would be a rather different country, I think.
I guess what I'm thinking of is there a loss? Is there a shift in how, you know, I've seen things on social media, sort of cartoons showing the change in who we listen to for our information. So you're mentioning sort of the pundit before, that the has a bigger voice that might shape someone's social identity by the things they say, by the platforms they sort of take on, or the sides they take on certain issues, that person replaced the scientists. And so is there a lack of trust in the scientists in the year 2019 more than there was maybe in the second half of the 20th century? Is there a shift in how we hear the scientist in the place of the scientist in the public forum, and is that shifting? Can you get a sense of that happening, especially with this idea about climate change?
Well, I'm not sure that it's a broad-based shift. There are certainly sections of the public that are rejecting science,
yeah,
because it doesn't fit their the beliefs that go with their social identity. Climate change is a big part of that. And a little bit of what you saw, there's been some good research on the rise of the conservative think tanks,
yeah,
which sort of rose to be a counterweight to science, to universities, to research professors and so forth, to create these white papers and other things that would argue from a conservative perspective and oppose what organizations like the National Academy of Sciences or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change,
uh-huh,
and the big organizations like the American Association for the Advancement of Science or the American Geophysical Union, you needed some counterbalancing voices that would speak against those but still use science words. And so there was this development of sort of a alternative oppositional publications and blogging and a whole information network. This was very clear a few years back on the various blogs for and against climate change. That there were people who would come out with an argument why a paleo climate study was flawed, and then lots of people who couldn't understand the arguments one way or another would just adopt the position that this study had been shown to be flawed, whether it really was or not. And I'm referring there to the famous hockey stick issue. It actually started out as papers that have since been very well replicated. But a lot of people only know what they read on the blogs that had been discredited.
So using the lexicon of science to discredit it. So there's a savvy...
Well, to provide people with an alternative that sounds like science also, but that supports their identity-consistent views.
Right. In 2016, you wrote a paper about the public awareness of the scientific consensus on climate. What did you find there, that a lot of people didn't even realize that scientists worldwide had come together and brought their research together and can show in a scientific way and in a rigorous way that this was happening? Are people just not aware of that?
A lot of papers these days, a lot of research papers, start out with the observation that something on the order of 97% of the scientists who study climate agree that humans are changing it, whereas the public perceives them as scientists as being sort of evenly divided. And that's partly a product of this sort of equal and opposite PhD thing that I was talking about. So the public perceives much more dissensus or lack of consensus than there is in reality. However, you still have something above 60% on general public surveys saying that most scientists agree. And when they say most scientists, they may not realize it's in the high 90s, but they're thinking at least a majority agree on this, and that's certainly accurate as far as it goes.
Right. So have you noticed, so since your first foray into the Arctic and then really into that 2006 data from the general... the GSS, the General Social Survey. Have you noticed a U.S. public becoming more concerned about the polar regions, the Arctic specifically, more knowledgeable? I mean, is that something you're tracking as well?
Well, that is something I'm tracking, and that's something I wish were happening, but in survey after survey, I'm looking for it, and it's not there. So there doesn't seem to be much improvement in public knowledge or concern. What has become clear is that there's two kinds of Arctic knowledge I was talking about, that there are these things that people just answer as if you would ask them an opinion question. Yeah. And there are other things that they really can't answer that way, but their opinions just whisper no clues. So I've just become aware that those two questions have really different, two kinds of questions have really different interpretations. If you ask people, is Arctic sea ice declining, to some extent, you might as well be asking them, do you think humans are changing the climate? Because there's just a great deal of overlap in how they would answer those two questions. On the other hand, if you ask people, is the North Pole over land ice or sea ice?
All right.
Their politics whisper no clues. And answers to that kind of question behave more like factual knowledge.
It's like Trivial Pursuit. And, that's like a Trivial Pursuit question.
Well, unless you've ever looked at a globe, in which case you'd realize that, there's an ocean at the top of the world.
Right.
Or you ever took grade school geography and had to memorize, what are the seven oceans of the world?
Right.
Or what are the continents? Then you would realize that Antarctica is a continent. So it's not trivial, and it's interesting to pair it with another question, which is, we ask this question, how well do you think you understand the issue of climate change? And then after we ask that, we do this sort of quiz on some of these surveys of questions like, you know, which of these better describes the North Pole? Is it a few feet or yard ice, a few feet or yards thick, floating over a deep ocean, or is it ice more than a mile thick over land? And then we ask the same question about the South Pole. And those are really basic geographical knowledge, and they behave that way. People who answer those questions know more about other things too. And your opinions don't whisper in your ear at all which way you should answer either of those questions.
Hmm. So it really makes a huge difference, like in all surveys, how you word those questions and how, and you're seeing that over time, doing these questions over and over, that once you give any hint of climate change, kind like that's what you're trying to get out of them, their belief in climate change, they'll answer in more of a belief kind of way. Is that a good way to?
Well, it's not a matter of the wording. It's the content. You know, is there?
Yeah.
So I can ask a question like, we did this on a survey 2 years ago in northern New England. Do you think the winters around here on average are any warmer than they were 20 or 30 years ago? And the real answer is yes. And this is affecting all kinds of things from the ski areas to maple sugar to when people's gardens bloom. You know, it's a big deal in snow country if winters are shorter now than they used to be.
Right.
And yet, the question doesn't mention climate change at all, but people will see the ghost of climate change lurking behind it. And those that reject the concept of climate change are the one group that will say, no, winters are not warming.
Wow.
So, you know, people of all ages, people of all educations, men and women, they all know the winters are warming. They can see it. Except for this group that rejects climate change on in terms of their socio-political identity, they don't see. They will not concede that winters are warmer now than they were 20 or 30 years ago. And I suppose, in a sense, this is where your socio-political identity is constraining your experience of physical reality.
Yeah, it's a distancing of that. There's this denial, it seems like, of you can't accept that
if you admitted that, then maybe other dominoes would fall over. And these are in questions that was carefully worded to say nothing whatsoever about climate change. And it's on a survey where no previous questions have asked anything about climate change. So people just intuit that that's a domino. I can't let that one fall and answer it consistent with their identity.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world.
Now let's get back to our episode.
Your methodology, is it, are these phone calls, like survey phone calls, or is it done through internet and people are...
Most of the surveys that I do nowadays are random sample telephone interviews.
Yeah.
Human interviewers, we never do robocalls or anything like that, and we also don't do internet surveys. But it's we have a very good operation at the University of New Hampshire, the survey center that works very hard and has done tens of thousands of interviews on these projects over the years.
Yeah.
Now, some of the others, such as the General Social Survey, are mostly face-to-face interviews, which is a much more, it's a very good quality approach, but it's extremely labor-intensive, very costly way to do surveys.
Sure. Now, does anyone in that moment, whether that's the face-to-face or the phone call, is there any record of how long it takes someone to answer a question?
We could reconstruct that, but the interviews in general last something on the order, the kinds of surveys I do, we aim for a 12 to 15 minute interview.
Yeah.
And that'll be something on the order of 42 questions, something like that. And they can always say they don't know or just refuse to answer. I try to write questions that are pretty clear, with some pretty stark choices that all sound reasonable. You know, between them, the choices should cover the main things people would want to choose.
Yeah. I guess my asking is, I'm just curious if the people that are, and this is my word, and I'm not trying to insert it into your research, but the deniers in northern New Hampshire, you said northern New England, about is the colder weather, is the winter shorter kind of question, are they taking time to think about that so that they don't allow those dominoes to fall, like you said? I wonder if that's something, or are they so sort of, they have their identity and they stick with it, and then the answer is really rapid and they're not even sort of belaboring it in their minds at all?
No, I haven't tried to systematically track that. From the days when I was doing pencil and paper surveys a long, long time ago, I noticed, because I had no money for a research assistant, I was coding the questionnaires myself, I noticed that there's a huge variation in how people would write their answers, with some people writing with a strong hand and giving you lots of opinions, and at the end of the questionnaire they would tell you what you should have asked instead, and other people would just write in these really shaky hands and give very short answers, and it was obviously a greater effort for them to be doing this thing. And I suspect that the phone interviews over the long run are like that too, that there are different people at different life stages and different levels of energy and self-confidence and so forth, who would answer fast and aggressively, and some would be puzzled and uncertain and so forth. So you probably get a lot of variation there. I don't know if that correlates with what answers they give, but it's certainly a person-to-person variation.
Yeah. One thing that I've been really interested in, it came out a few years ago, and it was in the Washington Post initially, and it was about looking at the correlation between people's knowledge, and this is U.S. people, thousands of people in the U.S. were surveyed, their knowledge of the location of Ukraine related to then their position on whether or not the U.S. should send troops in or send some sort of military assistance when the tensions were happening between Russia and Ukraine in Crimea. And what they found was they had everyone put a dot on where they thought the Ukraine was on a world map, right? And so the further those dots were from Ukraine, the more likely those people were to say, send military aid in. So it was the less they knew, the less geographic literacy they had, maybe the more, the easier it was for them to say, go in and have some sort of military intervention. And then three years later or 4 years later, a similar study was done with North Korea. And it's gotten me thinking about, you know, as someone who's involved in geographic education and geographic literacy, what's the relationship between how well we know a place and how much we kind of care about it? So we put this in the Arctic situation. Is there something there to be said that the more we know about the Arctic, the more maybe if we've been there or the more information, geographic information we have about it, are we more likely to A, understand climate change, B, I don't know, think, support political action that might be more about conservation? Is this anything that's kind of coming out of your research?
Well, that's an attractive idea, that the more people know, the better informed their views will be, the better choices they would make, the better policies they would support.
Right.
And I would say there is some support for that. One of our papers last year was about self-assessed understanding. And basically it put together this really simple 6-point knowledge score based on questions like, where's the North Pole? And then looked at how that correlated with other things. And it does have some correlations with views.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be even more true if you were talking not simply about geographic knowledge, but about some of the things that scientists are seeing. You know, the boots on the ice scientists out there who are watching the glaciers melt, you know, watching the sea ice, you know, which is setting new records, bad records, right now in the coast off Alaska, for example.
Right.
If people were more aware of this, they would maybe have less facile opinions that all comes from mathematical models and you can't trust them or something like that.
Right.
But I think. One of the questions we asked in our knowledge quiz was which of the following countries has territory and thousands of people living north of the Arctic Circle?
Hmm.
You know, it's like a grade school test. And the choices we give them are China, the United States, Great Britain, or Estonia, or none of the above. And the majority or the plurality think it's a trick question and that the answer is none of the above.
Right.
So they, you know, and only something like a fifth of American respondents realized that the U.S. has territory and people above the Arctic Circle. And kind of an amazing thing, you go to Alaska, which is about a quarter of the state is north of the Arctic Circle, and ask the same question, and only half the people in Alaska know that the U.S. has territory and people above the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
So the knowledge, geographic knowledge is extremely limited. Whether it was asking people where Ukraine is, or where is the North Pole, or you know, is any part of the U.S. in the Arctic, and I would like to think that people would give better answers if they had more knowledge. But that is to a surprisingly large extent by this political identity issue. That to some extent, people will acquire knowledge selectively to reinforce their prejudices.
And within that, knowing about the Arctic is just not on tops of people's lists. I mean, I guess part of this question too is, I would argue, but maybe it's just because I've become more tuned into the Arctic. But even before I knew I was going to go there, I would say that the Arctic has entered into popular science magazines like National Geographic, maybe more in the last two decades than the two decades prior. And does that... So there again, there's this equation of, does seeing the Arctic more in our public in the public forum, in our media, is that going to really, in the cynic in me, or the pessimist in me, I guess, says it might not change how we actually, if we care about it.
Well, I'm entirely with the optimist in you. I'm in favor of that, and I hope it's true.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason I'm doing these tracking surveys, watching for change. But the sort of flip side of that is that if people in an area where winters are long and cold and snowy reject the evidence that they are a little bit less long and cold and snowy than they were even in their lifetime a few decades ago, if people can reject that something that immediate and experiential, then those same identities may be able to, you know, reject changing in the face of better information about faraway places like the Arctic. So okay. I've got to say I would love to come up with a paper tomorrow that said, oh, it's all changing. The sun is rising, but as I watch the data, that's not what it's telling me.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition.
Last question. I was looking online, and are you currently teaching Introduction to Societies of the Far North?
I have a course called Society in the Arctic. It's an honors course for first-year students. They're at University of New Hampshire. They are required to take an interdisciplinary small group class, and this is one of them that meets that criteria, and it's a wonderful course to teach because the students have almost no preconceptions. I mean, it's like the ideal learning situation where they walk into the classroom knowing they don't know anything, and the only reason they're there is because they're curious. They want to find out. So it's a great course to be teaching.
And you teach it, is it a sociology course?
It meets this university requirement for as an interdisciplinary course that integrates material from a lot of different areas.
Yeah. What kind of things do you read in there, if you wouldn't mind sharing? Anything from, like, literature, or is it more scientific?
Well, a couple of good anthropological papers. Or books. There's one by Anna Kertula called Antler on the Sea, which is a fascinating study of a Siberian community before and after the fall of the Soviet Union. So it's you know, just sort of a fascinating big picture historical things happening in this tiny little place with thousands of years of traditional history as well. So that's one thing. I think we may be working with a new book by Elizabeth Marino called Fierce Climate, Sacred Ground, which is an anthropological study of Shishmaref, Alaska, which is a small coastal community in Alaska that's in danger of serious danger of erosion. A lot of the pictures people may have seen of houses falling into the sea are from Shishmaref. There's some work by a journalist, Nick Jans, who wrote a wonderful series of reports while he was living in Arctic Alaska. So, and we also look at things like the, I guess more academic, like the Arctic Human Development Report, which mm-hmm. is a bunch of chapters covering different aspects like education, health, and population.
Yeah. So it really kind of gives students a great overview of what's happening in the Arctic. Probably first, even delineating what the Arctic is, and walking them through a little bit of an introduction to the far north.
Yes. Well, we start out with I tell them this is like a grade school map quiz. I give them a list of 50-odd oceans, cities, countries, straits, et cetera, and say, okay, I'm going to give you a blank map, and you're going to have to find 20 or so of these on your first quiz.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really useful because nobody knows where the Barents Sea is or where is Svalbard or which one is Greenland, which one's Iceland, and so on and so forth.
Right.
But then in the first 2 weeks of class, they have to learn all that. And then by the end of class, each student has adopted a community to do their term paper on. And they get very proud and possessive about whatever small Arctic community or large Arctic community they are reporting on. And they give a talk and write a paper about a particular place, whether it's could be in an industrial city like Murmansk or Norilsk, or it could be a tiny little reindeer herding town in Finland or Norway.
They get to go deeper in that one place then.
Well, they do, and because every student gives a PowerPoint about his or her place, they all are exposed to all these very different things that they did not choose, that somebody else chose.
So that's episode 59, Climate Thinking Change. I want to thank Dr. Lawrence Hamilton for joining us from his office at the University of New Hampshire. I want to thank him for giving his time to talk to us about the perceptions of the Arctic. This whole series of Arctic episodes really was about that, and maybe we took more of a humanities social science approach in some of the interviews, in a historical approach as well, in some of our previous interviews. This was, I think, interesting for us to take a look at data and look at surveys and how people, their mental maps, if you will, of the Arctic and what they know about the Arctic. And that's what attracted me to this research and brought me there. I leave, and you heard in the question towards the end there, a little bit pessimistic and thinking, how much does our knowledge about a place, in this case the Arctic, but this could be anywhere, how much does that really change kind of how we feel about that or any kind of connection we might have to that place? I don't know. I could think of another example. Like, do we think differently about an earthquake in Haiti if we've been there or if we know people from there? I think that's true. What about the geographical knowledge of a place? How much does that shape the way we will feel about a natural incident, disaster, or some sort of social upheaval in that place? How will that influence our politics or potential political decisions we would want made about that place? But here, specifically, I guess, with the Arctic, though, we're talking about climate change and how much, I think, for me, getting at this was about how the Arctic, I think, will continue to be in the news as the region that's most affected by climate change. And will it shape then? I mean, will the Arctic and our thinking about that place as whether we think of it as a blank slate, if we think of it as a place that's unpopulated or underpopulated, if we think of it of a place as a place that's just ice, and our actual geographical knowledge of that place, how much will that, and I guess this is what it really comes down to for me, is how much will it make us care? And will it make us care not just about the Arctic, but then maybe take more seriously climate change scenarios and the science that's out about those change scenarios. So thanks again to Dr. Lawrence Hamilton. As always, thanks to Mike Allen for use of his song Sand Dune throughout the episode. And I want to end and give you a chance here to listen to one of the sounds from my trip to the Arctic back in June of 2019. This is what science would call bergy seltzer, and it's the sound of fragments of an iceberg that are sort of littered or scattered. Littered doesn't sound as nice. Scattered in the water. In this case, it was in a bay. And as the air is releasing from these chunks of ice, it makes this sound. I'll leave you with this. See you next month with the end of season 5 in episode 60.